of traditional typography. They used what was already present in the building, including the tools and hand printing knowledge. Artists are able to print their new age designs using these old printing methods. Some of the machines date back to the late 1800s. La Linterna was first founded to print newspapers. Later on, it began printing cinema and concert posters for famous artists.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
While the U.S. administration appears to be finally acknowledging the urgent need to address anti-Asian hate and discrimination, in the U.K., where the problem is equally grave, the authorities are still turning a blind eye to the plight of Asian communities. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article authored by Tom Masuda, a British Japanese writer based in London, entitled "It's Time to Talk About Anti-Asian Racism in the UK." The article has appeared on the front page of aljazeera.com. Please stay tuned. On March 16th, a man opened fire in three spa parlors in the U.S. city of Atlanta, killing eight people, including six Asian women. The shootings, the worst mass killing in the U.S. since 2019, drew long overdue attention to the rising wave of physical assaults, racial slurs, and verbal abuse Asian communities in the country have faced in the past year. Since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, former President Donald Trump and his supporters' attempts to baselessly blame it on China, there has been a major spike in anti-Chinese sentiment in the U.S. and in a country where many struggle to differentiate between Chinese people and other Asian ethnic groups, this resulted in a rising number of hate crimes against all East and Southeast Asians. The Stop AAPI Hate Reporting Center, which tracks incidents of discrimination, hate, and xenophobia against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in the U.S., recently revealed that they have recorded 3,795 anti-Asian racist incidents, including verbal harassment, shunning, and physical attacks between March 2020 and February 2021. Meanwhile, the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism found that the number of anti-Asian hate crimes reported to police rose 149% between 2019 and 2020. Of course, the rise in anti-Asian sentiment in the U.S. in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic did not happen in a historical vacuum. From the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 to the Japanese internment camps of the Second World War, America has a long history of scapegoating its Asian communities during major conflicts, crises, and catastrophes. In the UK, where the problem is equally grave, the authorities are still turning a blind eye to the plight of Asian communities. UK police data suggests a rise of 300% in hate crimes toward Chinese, East and Southeast Asians in the first quarter of 2020 compared with the same period in 2018 and 2019. According to End the Virus of Racism, a UK-based advocacy group, this trend continues to this day. In November last year, Edinburgh, Mumbai Sheikh was physically assaulted and racially abused by a group of teenagers while walking home with her two small children. She said they shouted COVID as they smacked her on the head, leaving her terrified. On March 1st, Chinese university lecturer Peng Wang was attacked by a gang of men in the city of Southampton. When asked what the men told him during the attack, he said, "They were saying things like Chinese virus, get out of the country," and dirty words. These are only two of the hundreds of racially motivated attacks faced by East and Southeast Asians in Britain since the beginning of the pandemic. Even Asian health workers who have been on the front line of the COVID-19 pandemic since the very beginning were not spared from such attacks. Just like in the US, anti-Asian sentiment in the UK has its roots in history. According to Dr. Anne Wichard, an expert on British-Chinese cultural relations from the University of Westminster, anti-Asian discrimination in the UK started as early as the turn of the 20th century, when Chinese immigrants started settling in the Limehouse area of London. In 1901, when the first Chinese laundry in the British capital opened, it was immediately stoned by a hostile crowd. In 1908, in opposition to cheap Chinese labor, crowds of angry British seamen prevented their Chinese colleagues from signing on as ship's crew. As more Chinese nationals began to settle in London and Liverpool during 1910s, Britain's newly emerged Chinatown started to be seen as centers of an exotic and highly dangerous underworld. Politicians manipulated local fears about cheap Chinese laborers, and writers of popular fiction began to exploit the dramatic potential of Chinese Limehouse in London as a locus of drug trafficking and gambling. As a result, anti-Asian sentiment grew across Britain. The discrimination and attacks against East and Southeast Asians in the country remained the norm for decades to come. For example, in the aftermath of the Second World War, Britain forcefully deported hundreds of Chinese seamen who had been recruited by the Royal Navy to help the war effort, deeming them an undesirable element in the British society. The state-sanctioned anti-Asian racism of the 20th century has not been addressed by the British authorities, and its legacy is still shaping the way thousands of East and Southeast Asians are being perceived and treated in the country to this day. British East and Southeast Asians are rarely represented in British television, theatre and cinema, even though they are the third largest racial ethnic minority in the country. And on the rare occasions they appear on screens or stages, they are often depicted in ways that feed into racist tropes. In the past year, East and Southeast Asians appeared in British media more than ever before, but always in the context of COVID-19 and the measures taken to stem its spread. These depictions help further establish the baseless belief that these communities are responsible for spreading the virus in Britain and contributed to the rise of anti-Asian sentiment in the country. Meanwhile, the state failed not only to stop this widespread scapegoating of British East and Southeast Asians for the pandemic, but also to protect these communities from the racially motivated abuse that followed. Just like it is the case in the US, the pandemic-related rise in anti-Asian sentiment and hate crimes in the UK can only be brought to an end if the state takes appropriate action. However, governments cannot end modern-day anti-Asian racism without first addressing the historic roots of the problem. Not any virus or disease, but a century of state-sanctioned exclusion and exoticization paved the way for the current wave of racism against British East and Southeast Asian communities. Therefore, a historical reckoning needs to be at the core of any efforts to stop it. But acknowledging and apologizing for past mistakes alone would not solve the problem either. Increasing East and Southeast Asian representation in all areas of British life, from politics to entertainment, also needs to be part of the game plan. British East and Southeast Asian stories, issues, and traditions needs to be put under a spotlight to ensure these communities are not reduced to racist stereotypes and instead accepted as intrinsic and valued parts of British society. Only then would Britain's East and Southeast Asian citizens and residents stop being devastated by the deadly virus of racism.
We get people.
Voting right under threat.
The so-called voting rights in the United States are coming under threat again, at least according to some politicians and activists in the country. The corporate GOP, in this case, is trying to ensure victory in upcoming elections by changing the rules in the key state of Georgia. Georgia played a crucial role in the Electoral College victory of President Biden in the 2020 presidential race.
It's got to stop, and it's going to stop with us. Folks, it's go time. There's 1 week left. Millions of Americans, over 60 million Americans, have already voted, and millions more by the end of this week. I believe when you use your power, the power to vote will change the course of this country. Right here in Georgia with all of you, these are the final days, so keep that sense of empowerment with you, that sense of optimism, what we can do, what we can overcome, what we will overcome. Look, folks, I've been around a while, but I've never been more optimistic about America or the American people than I am right today.
This is We the People, and I'm your host, Mila Javamadi. Voters in the traditionally red state, which surprisingly voted for Biden, will face absentee ID requirements, drop box limits, and quick runoffs. Join us today when we take a look into what has happened, not just in the Peach State, but in other key states as well. Stay with us.
I do live in Georgia, and I live in Atlanta, the moral capital of America, and the 10th largest economy in the U.S., and the 31st largest economy in the world, Atlanta, Georgia, built by black folks and brown folks working together and putting knucklehead stuff to the side. And this time, we flubbed it. They flubbed it. The bill is not just suppression. The bill is silly. It's a payback bill. When Hillary Clinton, who I know, lost the election, black folks accepted it. America accepted it. We didn't like it, but we accepted it. And we moved on and we supported the president. And we wished him well. When Mr. Trump lost, they should have accepted it. And they should have moved on and supported the new president. Period. That's what makes America great.
The law was passed in the Georgia House in the morning and approved by the Senate in the evening before being signed by Republican Governor Brian Kemp. The raft of new restrictions for voting and elections are complex, but some bizarre ones stand out. For example, it's a crime to offer food or water to voters waiting in lines.
This was passed, a 100-page bill was passed by the House and the Senate and signed by the governor in a single day. it is going to make it illegal to give somebody this that's standing in line to vote. I have never heard of water being an illegal substance in the United States. But, Brian, I'll get a lot of information on this bill, but when you tell people that they can't do something, what you're going to do is make them want to do it more. And I've said it on the show before, to black people, voting is something sacred, it's something inherent. We take voting for granted. We're never worried about voting rights in our lives.
On the other hand, some of the harshest restrictions proposed by Republicans were dismissed, such as limiting the role of black churches in bringing people to vote. The GOP's focus on Georgia comes after Biden flipped the state in the 2020 race. We're joined by Howie Hawkins to delve deeper into what is happening not just in Georgia, but also in several other states. Howard Hawkins is an American trade unionist and environmental activist from New York. A co-founder of the Green Party of the United States, Hawkins was the party's presidential nominee in the 2020 presidential election. Mr. Hawkins, first of all, let me ask you whether this has anything to do with the black vote.
It sure does. I mean, there's a long history of that in this country, unfortunately. And that's exactly what the Republicans in Georgia are doing. They're making it harder they're targeting African Americans, but as it has historically, it affects all low-income people. I mean, under Jim Crow, almost all black people were denied the right to vote, but so were about half of white people, generally the lower-income people. So they set up barriers to, registering to vote, staying registered, having time to vote, one thing after another. And it's all about suppressing the vote of black people and working-class people.
Nobody expected Georgia to vote for Biden. But the surprising move demonstrated how fast demographics are changing across the United States. Biden's narrow victory in Georgia involved only 12,670 votes. This was the first time a Democrat gained victory in a presidential race in Georgia since Bill Clinton was elected in 1992.
I was in Georgia yesterday.
With none? Jane Carter or just none?
Just as none. I had a meeting with Senator Carter, and I think
to win.
I think he's a good candidate. Yeah.
How do you build a coalition in Georgia to get a Democrat elected?
They're a long way from home.
Increase the number of African Americans are underregistered in Georgia historically, and Hispanics are in Texas.
Right.
If we can increase the number, increase the vote, then I think we just need to go out and
get a good successor,
find the rest of the state.
Headed by former President Trump, Republicans objected to the outcome, but they lost their final lawsuit as a court rejected their effort to block the results certification.
Unsubstantiated conspiracy theories and accusations of electoral fraud led to no tangible outcome in courts. But the GOP now appears to be up to something new. Our next guest is Donna Lieberman. Donna Lieberman has been the executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union since December 2001. She also founded NYCLU's Reproductive Rights Project. Ms. Lieberman, how do you assess the efficacy of the Republicans' latest attempt to, as some critics say, manipulate voting in Georgia?
Well, there are a number of ways that have been used in this country to manipulate voting. One is to keep people who are eligible to vote from actually voting. Another is through a process we call gerrymandering. It's by drawing election districts so that a person's vote doesn't really count as much as another's. And so both of those tactics are used in various places around the country, including Georgia. I think that were it not for voter suppression in Georgia and many other places, our country would have a much stronger Democratic majority and the politics of our country would be different.
The GOP knows that it basically cannot win elections without having the Georgia vote, as the state has been flipped at both the presidential and Senate levels. Therefore, Republican lawmakers in Georgia have passed a heavily restrictive bill to make sure their grip on power endures.
Look at the states where we're seeing the highest number of these restrictive bills get introduced, places like Arizona, Pennsylvania, and Georgia. And those are all three states that Joe Biden won very narrowly in 2020. Just in 2016, Donald Trump won all three of those states. So yeah, if these bills really do make it more difficult for people to vote or make it easier for mailed-in ballots to get rejected, when the margins are that close, you absolutely could see a difference in election outcomes in the future.
A similar law has already been passed in Iowa, but they do not end there, as plans are underway to restrict voting in the states of Arizona, Florida, and Texas.
Yes, Georgia is, however, especially significant as it marks the first major battleground in the new round of power play in America. Mr. Hawkins, what do you think about democracy in the United States, considering all the attempts to disrupt people's votes?
Well, the U.S. brags about its democracy, but studies done by academic institutes and there's a European commission comes out of the Helsinki Accords. The U.S. has been declining in terms of its ranking in terms of democracy for reasons like voter suppression, like blocking access to the ballot by third parties like the Green Party. And so we have a long way to go. We have a plurality voting system that, in the case of the United States, with an extremist right-wing Republican Party, a lot of progressives decide they got to vote for the centrist Democrats instead of the progressive Green Party in order to stop the Republicans. Most countries have some form of proportional representation where every party gets its fair and proportional share of representation in legislative bodies according to the support it has in votes. That's where the United States needs to move if it really wants to move and be a leader in democracy. But we're not there right now.
Trump specifically accelerated a deliberate strategy by Republicans to undermine election outcome when they did not find it favorable. The new changes will impact millions of voters in Georgia. Long lines could appear in elections. Republicans behind the latest move allege that the new bill is about security of the U.S. electoral process.
When Joseph Johnson went to vote in his first presidential election, this isn't what he expected.
The line went this way in front of our auditorium and then snaked around into our library.
The last person at his polling location didn't get to vote until 1 a.m.
It was the longest line that I've ever waited in my entire life. Some people, they were just like, well, screw it.
But are black people in Georgia convinced as well? Such moves are not limited to the state of Georgia, as the GOP remains steadfast to gain more support from the nation in all battleground states. Critics of the legislation say it will disproportionately affect people of color.
Well, I can't speak for black communities around the country, but we do know that black community supported by all those white and Latinx and people of all races and nationalities in Georgia and around the country are working very hard to resist the attack on the right to vote that is seen in Georgia now and that is being played out in many, many other states. This is an opportunity for our federal government, for the United States Congress, to step up and stand firm for democracy, to pass the Voting Rights Act, and to ensure that states can't wreak havoc with anybody's right to vote.
This isn't the first time Republicans are making it harder to vote. From gerrymandering to voter intimidation, USA's recent history is filled with such tactics. Take gerrymandering, which is the practice of manipulating district boundaries in the US electoral systems in an attempt to establish an unfair political advantage against the opposing party.
We have seen Republicans rig the system with their gerrymandering, often illegal gerrymandering.
There is gerrymandering to a fare thee well in states controlled by the Republicans.
Listen, political gerrymandering is probably one of the greatest threats to our democracy right now.
Gerrymandering argue that it allows politicians to choose their voters rather than allow voters to choose the politicians because it allows the legislature to draw lines that are really entirely safe for one party. The general elections really aren't competitive.
gerrymandered districts take forms that look bizarre if an actual community spread is taken into consideration. The strange maps gerrymandering has yielded in America is a living proof of racial and partisan power in the country's politics. The latest attempt in Georgia is, in part, being perceived as a racist attempt to suppress the black vote. How should the black communities in Georgia and across the country react to the latest move?
Well, they should make sure their federal representatives support the For the People Act. And they are resisting in Georgia. They are, despite the barriers put before them by the Republicans, they should and they are mobilizing to make sure their folks can get out to vote. Their folks are on the voter rolls. It's putting an extra burden on the black community, but I think they're up to the challenge. I think they got a sense of their power in the two special elections for Senate, and they're not going to let that power slip out of their hands easily.
Critics of the GOP move in Georgia believe that the legislation is discriminatory and unconstitutional, while disproportionately harming black voters. Since its nascent days, the U.S. has been a struggling ground for many, including the slaves who built America on the foundation of human suffering, to today's youths grappling with the dire socioeconomic barriers in the hope of achieving the American dream.
How do you feel about the American dream? The idea of it?
I love it. I've lived it. My family immigrated to this country.
Do you still believe in it?
Well, I'm a numbers guy, and so the numbers say that you have a 50-50 chance of doing better than your parents if you're born in the 90s. And that chance was 93% if you were born in the 40s or 50s. So the American dream is dying by the numbers, and Americans know it.
America today is a dreadful, divided republic facing an existential crisis emanating from increasing hate and division. It's no surprise to see both conservatives and liberals resort to unprecedented tactics to expand their sphere of influence. So, is federal authority coming under threat?
Efforts to suppress the vote by black people or others are an attack on democracy. But in our constitutional system, the regulation of the election process is left to each state. However, we used to have a federal voting rights law with a lot of teeth to it, and there is an effort in the United States Congress to restore the Voting Rights Act that the United States Supreme Court kind of gutted a couple of years ago. And there's a majority of support for restoring the Voting Rights Act and the Put People First Act that would make it impossible for the obstacles like Georgia to get in the way of the right to vote.
Our federal system gives administration of elections in large degree to the states, but Congress can set federal standards, and that's what the For the People Act, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, and some other legislation before Congress would do, and then that would preempt what's going on in the states. And that's really what needs to happen. And this has been a problem since Reconstruction ended, when the federal government withdrew its responsibility to ensure that the freed enslaved people had their civil rights and their voting rights. So we've been fighting this for, you know, over 200 years.
The country's most hotly contested state is facing the new wave voter suppression based on the rationale that there was widespread voter fraud in Georgia in the 2020 elections. But allegations of widespread voter fraud that could effectively lead to a different outcome were all rejected despite numerous lawsuits.
Yeah, they're pretty much small bore cases. They're not really major cases. Most of them are trying to do something like get better access for Trump observers to be able to get into polling places. That might be to try to slow the vote count down in places where Trump is trying to stop, like in Pennsylvania, a Biden win. There was one case of an allegation of illegal ballots being counted in Georgia, and a court found that there was no evidence for that. There have been suggestions that they're going to file suit either for a recount in Wisconsin. They've claimed that there are non-residents voting in Nevada, but they haven't produced these suits yet, and they haven't produced any evidence to support the kind of claims in these suits yet.
No matter what, a political storm appears to be blowing through Georgia. The country's most heated battleground is part of a bigger project to shape the power dynamics across key states in the wake of Trump's rather embarrassing loss in November. The former president indeed played a key role in how voter suppression is underway today.
What we saw was a remarkable effort to flip the script on free and fair elections, with Trump and his crew claiming that the election was stolen, when in fact, through the use of an orchestrated campaign of voter suppression, they have sought to steal elections in the past by keeping people from voting through voter suppression laws and through vote dilution programs like the gerrymandering that dilutes the strength of black votes or progressive votes in a particular country, jurisdiction. But I think that effort is finally being revealed for what it is, the attack on democracy, and the pushback is strong. It has mobilized people who believe in democracy and may not have bothered to vote in the past to get out there and vote themselves, to help other people register to vote, and to make sure that everybody who meets the qualifications, who's of 18 years old, registers and votes and gets their votes counted. And these sneaky ways to stop people from voting hopefully will become a thing of the past.
The decision in Georgia faced backlash from several corporations, including Coca-Cola and Facebook. Apart from that, it has revived a national conversation over voting rights across the nation. While imposing restrictions, the 98-page bill reportedly expands some people's access to in-person early voting in Georgia.
Coca-Cola's president says he is disappointed the law passed, adding, "Voting in our country is a sacred right and duty, and we recognize we have a responsibility to protect and promote it." A similar sentiment from Delta Airlines, calling voting access a fundamental right for all citizens, but upsetting some activists after parts of the statement appeared to praise the law, arguing it improved considerably during the legislative process.
It's not just a Georgia issue, it's a national issue, and they can't sit on the sidelines.
How the situation will pan out in the prime battlefield for showdowns between Democrats and Republicans is yet to materialize, but will have significant implications for the rest of the country. The American people, meanwhile, keep wondering whether more barriers to voting are on the horizon.
A lot of people don't understand what democracy really means, and that it means allowing free speech, allowing free elections, and ensuring that everybody who is eligible to vote can vote. That means not trying to suppress the voting rights or dilute the votes of any group simply because, you know, a majority doesn't like what they think or wants to keep them from gaining power. So I think our democracy has faced the gravest danger in my lifetime, for sure, under the Trump administration. But I think the American people spoke loud and clear. And even as if we had one hand tied behind our back, the people spoke at the polls in the last election. And I think that there will be a lot of efforts to bring out the vote and to make sure that our democracy is safe.
Three groups have already filed lawsuit in an effort to salvage the integrity of elections in Georgia. During the 2020 campaigning days, Trump especially fixated on the state and made it the main focus of his efforts to overturn the results of the national election. Yet, he failed without conceding defeat.
If your basis for not conceding is that there was voter fraud, then show us. We can't back you blindly without evidence.
Republican Senator Mitt Romney calling Trump the 900-pound gorilla when it comes to the Republican Party, with this warning.
It's important for the cause of democracy and freedom that we don't allege fraud and theft and so forth, unless there's very clear evidence of that.
The Republicans now seem to be on the path to repeat their agenda of shrinking the vote in their own favor. Desperate to seek justice and equality, everyday Americans lay hope on Democrats by voting for them into office. But neither party appears to be really after solving people's problems. Thank you for staying with us. I'm your host, Mila Javar Magi. Tune in for the next episode when I come back with a new topic on We the People.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Cathay Pacific Airlines convinced that digital proof of coronavirus vaccination will bring about the return of safe international travel, asked its pilots and crew to try out a new mobile app that showed their vaccination status on a recent flight from Hong Kong to Los Angeles, California. New York has rolled out Excelsior Pass, billed by the state as a free, fast, and secure way to present digital proof of COVID-19 vaccination in case reopening sports and entertainment venues requires proof of attendee status. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Cheryl Gay Stolberg and Adam Liptak. The piece is titled Likely Legal, Vaccine Passports Emerge as the Next Coronavirus Divide. Stay with us for more. Cathay Pacific Airlines convinced that digital proof of coronavirus vaccination will bring about the return of safe international travel, asked its pilots and crew to try out a new mobile app that showed their vaccination status on a recent flight from Hong Kong to Los Angeles. New York has rolled out its Excelsior Pass, billed by the state as a free, fast, and secure way to present digital proof of COVID-19 vaccination in case reopening sports and entertainment venues require proof of attendee status. And Walmart, America's largest private employer, is offering electronic verification apps to patients vaccinated in its stores so they can easily access their vaccine status as needed, the company says. Around the country, businesses, schools, and politicians are considering vaccine passports, digital proof of vaccination against the coronavirus, as a path to reviving the economy and getting Americans back to work and play. Businesses especially fear that too many customers will stay away unless they can be assured that the other patrons have been inoculated. But the idea is raising charged legal and ethical questions. Can businesses require employees or customers to provide proof, digital or otherwise, that they have been vaccinated when the coronavirus vaccine is ostensibly voluntary? Can schools require that students prove that they have been injected with what is still officially an experimental prophylaxis, the same way they require longer proof vaccines for measles and polio? And finally, can governments mandate vaccinations or stand in the way of businesses or educational institutions that demand proof of vaccination? Legal experts say the answer to all of these questions is generally yes, though in a society so divided, politicians are already girding for a fight. Government entities like school boards and the army can require vaccinations for entry, service and travel, practices that flow from a 1905 Supreme Court ruling that said states could require residents to be vaccinated against smallpox or pay a fine. A community has a right to protect itself against an epidemic of disease which threatens the safety of its members, Justice John Marshall Harlan wrote in Jacobson v. Massachusetts, the 1905 case. Private companies, moreover, are free to refuse to employ or do business with whomever they want, subject to only a few exceptions, ones that do not include vaccination status. And states can probably override that freedom by enacting a law barring discrimination based on vaccination status. But as the nation struggles to emerge from the worst public health crisis in a century, the arrival of digital vaccine verification apps, a modern version of the World Health Organization's yellow card that provides international proof of yellow fever vaccination, has generated intense debate over whether proof of vaccination can be required at all. On Tuesday, the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, became the latest Republican governor to issue an executive order barring state agencies and private entities receiving funds from the state from requiring proof of vaccination. The World Health Organization, WHO, citing equity concerns, also said on Tuesday that it currently did not support mandatory proof of vaccination for international travel. Others are moving forward. Universities like Rutgers University, Brown University, and Cornell have already said they will require proof of vaccination for students this autumn. The Miami Heat this week became the first team in the NBA to open special vaccinated-only sections. And though businesses have yet to announce outright bans on unvaccinated clientele, some states and technology firms are preparing. At least 17 companies or non-profit organizations are developing websites or apps that might be used by sporting venues, restaurants, and other businesses seeking to keep their customers and employees safe, according to Joel White, the executive director of the Health Innovation Alliance, a broad coalition of health providers, technology companies, employers, and insurers. We'll be right back. airlines, including JetBlue and United Airlines, are also testing the Common Pass app, developed by the Commons Project, a non-profit trust dedicated to using technology to help people control their personal information. Airlines for America, the trade group for the nation's major carriers, opposes making proof of vaccination mandatory for air travel, but would like a clean, easy way for travelers to show their status. Other countries may require proof of vaccination, and the apps can also be used to prove negative coronavirus test results, which the United States requires for international travelers. On the face of things, requiring proof of vaccination seems a lot like no shoes, no shirt, no service, said Mark Tushnet, a law professor at Harvard University. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, already provides everyone who is vaccinated a card that can serve as proof, and people can always carry paper records of negative coronavirus tests. But industry leaders liken digital vaccination apps to security screening services like TSA PreCheck. It is not required, but it might make the travel experience smoother. Backers of digital vaccination cards are pressing the Biden administration to become involved, at least by setting standards for privacy and for verifying the accuracy of the records. The White House, though, is clearly skittish. The government is not now, nor will be, supporting a system that requires Americans to carry a credential, Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, said on Tuesday. Jen Psaki added, there will be no federal vaccination database and no federal mandate requiring everyone to obtain a single vaccination credential. She promised that the Biden administration would provide some form of guidance, most likely in the form of questions and answers, about privacy, security, discrimination, and concerns. Last week, the chief technology officer of the Department of Health and Human Services held a conference call with state and local health officials who are mystified by the administration's reticence. It's going to be necessary to have this, and there is going to have to be some kind of system where it's verified, said Dr. Marcus Plescia, the chief medical officer of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. Dr. Marcus Plescia added, I think everybody in our network is a little bit perplexed by the way the federal government seems to be at arm's length with this. One arm of the government has offered some help. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has told employers that they can mandate coronavirus vaccination because public health comes first. But if an employee cannot get vaccinated because of a disability or a sincerely held religious belief, and a company cannot make an accommodation, the agency said, then it would be lawful for the employer to exclude the employee from the workplace.
Ministry.
Seven years into the brutal Saudi war on Yemen, the Yemeni armed forces refused what they called the deceitful ceasefire offer of Al Saud. 6 full years of massacres and bombardment campaigns, sanctions and blockade, and Al Saud blatantly want the Yemeni Salvation Government to give up arms and negotiate. However, the Yemeni resistance Ansarullah have refused to put down their weapons and enter any Saudi proposed talks before the full cessation of the Saudi war and the lift of all forms of blockade against the Yemeni nation. The Saudi plan supposedly includes a UN-supervised ceasefire, measures to reopen Sana'a airport in the Yemeni capital, and the lifting of trade restrictions on the Ansarullah-controlled Hudaydah port, but with a twist. The Saudis want to control the airport and the seaport themselves, while also sharing revenues on trade in oil through Hudaydah. Mohammed bin Salman wants to snatch through politics what he was not able to achieve through 6 years of extensive warfare against Yemen. For the Yemeni resistance, the devil is in the details. The Saudi aim is clear: control of vital Yemeni port of entries after they successfully suffocated the nation, leading it to become the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Whereas the Yemeni resistance wants Hodeidah port and Sana'a airport to be completely open to all international traffic, as they should. The Saudi overture appears to double down on the idea that it is the Yemeni resistance who is being asked to make concessions here, at a time when not only most Saudi-occupied cities have been liberated, but also scores of bomber drones on a weekly basis keep revisiting Saudi oil facilities and military bases in the heart of the kingdom. Ansarullah's response was very clear. This is an old offer, they said. Any new offer should begin with completely lifting barriers to movement on Hodeidah Port and Sana'a Airport. Using the humanitarian crisis as leverage is simply seen as a deceitful Saudi attempt, and Yemen will not fall for it. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. After 6 years of brutal Saudi war on Yemen, the Saudi ceasefire offer was taken by Yemen as nothing short of a joke. What is proposed to the Yemenis is not an end to the war. It is just a ceasefire while all other forms of war continue, such as blocking the airport, seaport, and the borders. What is proposed to Yemenis is a major deceit that neither Ansarullah or the Yemeni children would even accept to fall for. To discuss this issue with us from London is Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire. Thank you a lot for being with us, Patrick. Now, Yemeni officials in Sana'a have recently emphasized that Yemen is only open to what they called a fair and honorable peace. That has nothing to do with the deceitful act of the ceasefire offer by Al Saud there, but while maintaining the blockade and maintaining the bombardment campaign against civilian areas in Yemen. Why is the world acting like Yemen has any other option than to actually wait for the war to stop and the blockade to be lifted?
I don't think Saudi Arabia or the world, the Western world for that matter, I don't think they're in a sort of space of reality, because these are all negotiation tactics that we have seen in the past. So, and the West, Saudi Arabia, these powers, they believe that they have leverage on the basis that they have military superiority and they have regional hegemony and they have control of the major waterways, ports, et cetera, the sky, the air, et cetera. So this is why they're negotiating as if the Yemeni Ansarullah's capitulation is a fait accompli, but that's not actually how it works when you're in a conflict. And right now, Saudi Arabia is still the aggressor. They can't change that fact. They're in a foreign country, so they don't have the leverage. And so they want to continue to strangle the Yemenis, to strangle Ansarullah in order to somehow get some concessions or some leverage on negotiation. And the Yemenis aren't going to agree to a ceasefire without getting exactly what they want, especially after everything that's happened.
This is why we should maybe look into this initiative. The Saudi initiative is said to include a nationwide ceasefire under the control or the supervision of the UN, supposedly. The reopening of Sana'a Airport and Hodeidah Port. But knowing that the power in those areas, Hodeidah Port, the airport, are in the hands of Ansarullah, could this actually be some sort of a new maneuver from Mohammed bin Salman to try and take control over them, since he already failed to do so militarily?
Possibly, but it could also be a sort of a long-term or medium to long-term strategy, because we've seen this in Syria. We've learned over the last few years that when an international ceasefire is declared, one party will use this as an opportunity to retrench or to sort of double down or to gain some ground that they had previously lost. Certainly this is something strategically that Saudi Arabia and its backers would like to do. And so for the Yemenis, they're totally in a defensive position, so there's no really change in their strategy. But so the West, who's backing Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis and their allies, were looking for some changes
in order to change the strategic landscape. So we've also seen this in Libya. You have half the country, or Tripoli, under a UN administration, as it were. In Yugoslavia, we saw similar tactics with third parties coming in like the UN, and that can create other situations that's going to disrupt or allow one party not to be able to realize the gains that it would like on the battlefield, as it were.
But Patrick, with 5 million people currently teetering on the edge of starvation, and we have over two-thirds of the country's population in need for both food, medicine, and protection. Do you think that Yemen still has more time to waste for such a stalemate offer by Saudi Arabia? And what is the role of the international community in this one?
In terms of the famine, in terms of the human devastation, the humanitarian devastation, there's not a lot that can be done outside of Saudi Arabia withdrawing, its allies withdrawing, and basically leaving Yemen to govern itself, which was the previous status quo. Outside of that, it's going to be difficult. The end game has always been, for Saudi Arabia and its allies, has been partition or regime change, or both. And I really truly believe that they thought this was going to be over within 18 months of when it began in March of 2015, and that hasn't been the case. So if the Yemenis are still where they were before, they're still fighting to preserve their sovereignty, and that's not really going to change despite the devastation.
Well, the Rights and Legal Department at the Yemeni Ansarullah Political Bureau issued its first human rights document that was issued about a week ago about brutal crimes committed by the Saudi-U.S. aggression against Yemeni civilians. We have, it was, by the way, entitled Yemen's Hiroshima. The report included 4,133 documented massacres and bombing incidents in residential areas with details regarding the time and the place of their occurrences. Saudi Arabia has been stacking war crimes in Yemen for the past 6 years. Will Mohammed bin Salman and maybe his generals ever be brought to justice over these horrendous crimes? Do we have a chance against these people?
I think it's doubtful, and this is because international law is at an all-time low, and it's really receding year by year. The only person that's going to get justice from the international law system or end up in The Hague will be some African dictator that was probably installed by a Western power to begin with. Those are the only people you ever see showing up in The Hague, more or less. But so the bottom line is that what Saudi Arabia has done is guaranteeing bad blood between the neighbors on the Arabian Peninsula. And so you can't erase that. This is going to sow the seeds for potentially future conflicts. There needs to be a unilateral withdrawal on the side of Saudi Arabia and a cessation of hostilities. This is the only way that we're going to avert more humanitarian disaster. Everything besides that is just really going to be a protracted, painful conflict, unfortunately. And well, we'll see if the West is going to come in like a knight on a white horse to try to, you know, broker some sort of negotiations, but or some roadmap to peace. But at the end, I think it's too late for that.
Well, it seems that Biden is a bit in hot water whether to back Mohammed bin Salman or not. Sometimes he gives him a good word, sometimes three bad words in a row. But at the same time, Yemeni civilians are losing their lives. They're losing their lives from bombs falling on their heads, Western-made bombs. They're losing their lives from the famine created by Saudi Arabia with the help of the West. And at the same time, if the West thinks really that they're going to try and do anything to stop this without the consent of the Yemeni people, those same Yemenis that are still in control of swaths of land of their country that have been able to liberate the occupied parts of their country, then they are really on a wrong side here. They don't really understand Yemenis yet. I want to thank you very much, Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire, for being with us. Now, please stay tuned. We will be next talking about the Lebanese crisis of economy. Stay with us.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly